It's a working title. We had one bottle of water, the rest was tap, I think. Mabbott persisted. I can't let you sabotage my second day. There, two San Pellegrinos, we only have one. The waitress looked down at the bill for some time, as if trying to decipher ancient runes.
OK, I change.
Cilla reached for her coat. The life of a writer is unlike any other, Keith. It's lonely, it's unpredictable, it's blown by the winds. So?
A writer's mind must never be closed. It's his duty to be curious, and my duty to feed that curiosity. Think of it as the start of a big adventure.
She gave him a brisk, breathy hug.
Meeting's at 11. Pick you up at 10.
I'll take the tube. She frowned.
They're in darkest Southwark, darling.
For Cilla, public transport was a foreign country. She shook her hair, pulled on a beret, and smiled reassuringly.
I'll send Hector.
Which was exactly why Mabbott had suggested taking the tube. Chapter 4 Cilla Caldwell was one of the few writer's agents who still employed a driver. This was partly to do with an old-fashioned concern over image, and partly because a year or so previously, she totaled her own car after a carafe too many with the Swedish thriller writer. No one had been hurt, and it was quite likely she would have got away with it, had the car she'd hit not had a policeman in it. With a deftly mixed cocktail of charm and remorse, Cilla had avoided public opprobrium, and all who knew her reckoned she'd been very lucky indeed. Apart from the loss of a colourfully eccentric alpha spider, the only real penalty she'd incurred was the arrival of Hector Fisher in her life. And it was Hector Fisher's large, close-shaven, ever-so-slightly perspiring head that Mabbott could see from the back of the BMW as they sat becalmed in the Russell Square one-way system.
"She was no good for him,"
Hector insisted in his menacing Austrian accent.
"No good for him at all."
Cilla was deep in a phone call. So Mabbott felt duty-bound to respond.
"So what did he do?"
Hector's eyes flicked up to the mirror and focused on Mabbott, like someone peering into a house through the letterbox.
"What did he do? What would you do?"
The traffic edged forward. Keith, whose attention had wandered during the early part of the story, shook his head equivocally.
"I've no idea."
"You've no idea. A woman you've helped out of the gutter turns and spits on you, and you've no idea?"
Fisher braked sharply to avoid killing a frail elderly person who was making their way over a designated crossing.
"I tell you what I would do,"
he shouted over the blast of his car horn.
"I would have kicked her out and changed the locks. That would be my idea of what to do."
They turned into Doughty Street. When he'd first arrived in London, Mabbott had come down here to pay homage to Charles Dickens, who'd lived and worked in one of these houses.
"Every time she sobbed a tear and shook her bum, he took her back. 'Oh, it's okay, don't worry, I'll look after you. Put your head on my shoulder, there.'"
After all these years, the amount of history in a single London street was still something to marvel at.
"I would have said there was only one place for that head, on the block."
Hector chuckled grimly and accelerated towards a traffic-calming platform ahead of them.
"On the block,"
he repeated with satisfaction. Cilla finished one call and started another. Mabbott decided to feign sleep. Urgent Books occupied the first two floors of an old tobacco warehouse on the south bank of the river between Southwark and London Bridge. It had been brusquely converted for a quick sale at the height of the property boom, and despite its cast-iron columns and sturdy brick walls, the change of use had rendered it virtually indistinguishable from a host of similar commercial developments which had sterilised a once quirky riverside. Automatic glass doors gave access to a wide open-plan reception area, a curious conjunction of marble-tiled floor and whitewashed brick walls. A curving glass staircase led up to a gallery and a bank of lifts serving the upper floors. Mabbott and Cilla were halfway up the stairs when a wiry, athletic man strode out onto the balcony above. Cilla waved. He nodded back at her with a wink that could have been a twitch. Or just a wink. Ron Latham didn't fit any preconceived idea Mabbott had of a publisher. He had very black curly hair and an almost unnaturally clear complexion, such as you might see on a waxwork. His shirt was collarless and worn tucked into snug-fitting black jeans. He wore a pair of rimless glasses, so thin that they almost could be mistaken for part of his skull. His age could have been anything between 25 and 45. He greeted Scylla with a kiss, and Mabbott with a firm grip from a surprisingly soft hand.
"Ron Latham. I'm the CEO. Everyone calls me Ron."
He smiled mirthlessly and led them through an open-plan office past 20 or 30 consoles from which no one looked up. At the far end was the only room with a proper door, steel, with a hardwood finish. Latham held it open and beckoned them into a conference room with a wide picture window overlooking the Thames. Mabbott caught sight of a train rumbling over the bridge to Cannon Street Station before Latham pressed a remote control and blinds clicked into place.
"Sorry, bit bright. Coffee?"
A complete breakfast had been laid out at one end of the glass-topped conference table. Latham poured coffee and stretched his arm out over the spread.
"There's juice and pastries, croissants, whatever you want."
He didn't make it sound tempting. Latham and Scylla talked a little of mutual friends and the ups and downs of the market. The two of them seemed comfortable together. Mabbott looked about him. At one end of the room stood an easel from which hung sheets of paper, ruffled almost imperceptibly by the softly humming aircon. Considering this was a publishing house, there were very few books to be seen. Maybe this was the shape of the future, the world on a screen. Mabbott was old-fashioned in these matters. He used a mobile and a computer, neither very competently, but when he was on the road, his first point of contact remained his notebook and pencil. As he reached for a croissant, Mabbott caught Latham's eye. Latham smiled crisply, professionally. Maybe he was nervous too, for when he spoke, it was with a touch of unconvincing matiness.
"I've known Priscilla since she worked the showbiz pages at the Chronicle Group. I like her, because she's always gone her own way. Never followed the herd."
Mabbott was about to reach for the butter, but thought better of it.
"So when this came along, she was the first person we went to for a recommendation."
Mabbott looked across at his agent. Her expression gave no hint of her trademark hard-nosed scepticism. Instead, she stared back at him with a look of bright anxiety, like a mother who was taking her child to the doctor. Latham finished his coffee and put his cup back on the table. He smiled.
"She thought of you."
"For what, exactly?" asked Mabbott.
"Something quite exciting."
Latham indicated a row of chairs, and at the press of a remote control, a screen purred down from the ceiling.
"This is super confidential, but it'll give you some idea of what we're after."
He flicked the remote, and the room darkened. Suddenly the screen was illuminated, and an arresting image appeared. A figure walking from left to right across what looked like stony scrub in some hot country. The camera zoomed in and revealed an imposing middle-aged to elderly man with a mane of thick greying hair. Mabbott recognised the man even before the title caption came up.
"Hamish Melville," intoned a sententious voiceover. "Aged 75. Anthropologist and activist."
A series of close-ups showed a large head and a strong face with eyes deep-set beneath the brow, as if they were peering out from the mouth of a cave. The face was not so much handsome, the nose and cheekbones were too prominent for that, as it was mesmerizing. The way John the Baptist looked in Renaissance paintings, an impression strengthened by hair worn long and tangled. Various film clips followed, usually shot on the move, with Melville striding through the bush, or surrounded by a group of tiny tribal people, or, in one case, sitting cross-legged with a group of fellow protesters in front of a police line. Place names clicked up on the screen. Bangladesh, Brazil, Borneo, all the environmental hotspots. The presentation was clinical and factual, but to Mabbott it was fascinating stuff. In an age of universal access, Hamish Melville remained an enigmatic maverick, the action man of the environmental movement. Mabbott was familiar with the background. The cancellation of the million-dollar Puerto Renca dam project and the saving of the Akwambe lands in the Niger Delta were just two of Melville's successes. Yet the man himself was famously reclusive. He rarely gave interviews, and when he did, they were more likely to be for a school magazine than a national broadsheet. Apart from his hit-and-run campaigns, his legendary influence on everything from conflict resolution to economic development stemmed from two books and the occasional address, delivered, more often than not, to a convention of rickshaw drivers rather than a UN assembly. For journalists of Mabbott's generation, this combination of the inspirational and the subversive was a constant source of speculation. They admired and envied Melville's unique ability to stay out of the headlines and yet remain extraordinarily effective in pricking consciences. To see these glimpses of the great man, working on a farm, riding a train, swimming and laughing in some frighteningly turbulent river, was almost like watching footage of some old communist icon. The last sequence was quite different. It was a montage of maybe a dozen shots of Melville in urban locations, caught on what looked like a CCTV camera, leaving an airport, entering a building, on the steps of a government facility, shaking hands with movers and shakers. In some of them, Melville wore a suit. In one, getting into a large car, with security men holding the door, he was carrying a briefcase. On this last, incongruous image, the commentary drew to a conclusion. Who is the real Melville, and where does his power lie? Melville, the true story, an urgent exclusive. Coming to you next Christmas. The words faded, and slowly the lights came up. Latham reached for the remote. The screen ascended, disappearing soundlessly into the ceiling. Almost simultaneously, the blinds folded back and daylight flooded the room.
That's interesting stuff, Mabbott murmured.
He glanced toward Cilla.
But why are we watching Hamish Melville home movies?
Latham raised his immaculately trimmed eyebrows.
More coffee?
Mabbott shook his head. Latham stood, refilled his own cup, added sugar, glanced briefly towards the door, then turned back again.
We, that is, Urgent Books, want to commission a book on Melville. Everyone loves him. Everyone respects him. He's admired all over the world, by the people whose land he saves, by the conservationists and the ecologists, as well as a hell of a lot of people who don't agree with what he's saying, but like the way he says it. And he has an international profile.
Latham walked towards the window, stirring his coffee.
He isn't government, he isn't UN. He's not a bureaucrat or a politician. He's never accepted an honour or a medal. He's one of the last of an almost extinct species. The free spirit, the lone wolf, the guy who does what he thinks is right and argues about it afterwards. He's an inspiration to some, a bloody nuisance to others. Yet the real Hamish Melville is a mystery. We know jack shit about the man himself. How he lives, works, operates. What he really wants to achieve. That's the gap we want to fill.
Latham turned and looked at Mabbott.
And? And we want you to fill it.
This was so completely not what he'd expected that at first Mabbott could come up with no reaction at all. He needed a moment to decode the complex mix of excitement and unease that had suddenly come over him.
Me?
Aware that his voice sounded shrill, he paused and came down an octave.
I mean, why me? As you can imagine, Melville isn't the sort of man for a celebrity biog or a memoir. He'd run a mile from a star performer. He'd sniff out anyone with an agenda. It's happened before. Good journalists, top writers, have tried to get close and failed miserably.
So why would I be different? Asked Mabbott. Latham moved towards him. He was talking faster now, like someone homing in on a target.
Syl has filled me in on you, Mabbott. And I hope you won't mind me saying this, but you don't carry any intimidating baggage with you. You're not a celebrity. Your name is hardly a household word. You're...
His brow furrowed momentarily.
Your record is solid, but unspectacular. Even possibly a little dull. But you can write. She's shown me your stuff, and it's fine.
Somewhere behind him, Mabbott heard his agent clear her throat. Latham continued.
You've been a journalist. You know about deadlines. You know about sources. And environment is your thing. You expose that water company. You're used to working under the radar. But most of all, Priscilla tells me you're basically an honest man, a straight guy. Someone we could depend on.
Keith stole a glance at Scylla. She smiled back. But he wanted more than that. Some guidance, for God's sake, as to how he should be dealing with all this. Latham pulled out a chair and sat down close to Mabbott.
We'll make it worth your while, of course.
Mabbott felt claustrophobic. He didn't like this place, he didn't like this man, and he had been in the business long enough to know that publishing houses were not charities.
But we're not a charity, Mr. Mabbott. Your part of the deal is to produce the book, start to finish, in 6 months flat.
Mabbott felt a rising panic.
I'm writing a novel. The company wants this to be one of our lead titles for next Christmas, so I need it by April at the latest, for legal checks, rights sales and so on. And I will need complete confidentiality. If anyone asks, you're writing an overview of environmental movements.
But I'm writing a novel, Mabbott repeated. Latham leant closer to him.
What's really important is that you look at every aspect of the man. I mean every aspect.
We don't want a fanzine, Mabbott. We want the truth. Latham stood. He repositioned his chair carefully at the table. A martinet, thought Mabbott. Not bright, but neat. Likes things just so.
Scylla and I can discuss the details.
Ron Latham extended his hand to Mabbott, and they made their way to the door.
Good to meet you, Keith.
Mabbott wanted to get his thoughts in order to express clearly and unequivocally what his position was, but he couldn't think how to do it. Nor, it seemed, was he going to be given the opportunity. He gave a last instinctive look towards Scylla. She nodded back eagerly.
Call you,
she said, half standing and motioning towards the exit. Latham was already at the door, holding it open for him.
I hope you're as excited as we are.
Chapter 5. The glass doors of the Urgent building quietly slid shut behind him. Mabbott stood in the small brick plaza. Around him, office workers were occupying the steps and unpacking lunches. He felt confused, out of place. A purposeless man in a purposeful world. He turned left, then right, heading instinctively towards the river. When he reached Bankside, he picked his way through the cross-current of ambling tourists and keen-eyed joggers and found the reassurance of a bulky granite wall. He leant out over the parapet and looked at the river. It was high tide, and a stiff breeze was sloshing the water about. The horn of a passing barge blasted out, like an elephant in pain. Mabbott stared across the river, his eyes moving east to west across the oddly assorted clumps of buildings that made up the north bank. Hardly welcoming, the towers of the city held their own secrets. The ivy-clad walls of the Inns of Court protected their inmates from curious glances. The smooth stone bulk of the Ministry of Defence and the carved and curlicued Houses of Parliament, accessible only by special pass, took up another half-mile of London's private riverside. A pair of runners thudded by behind him. Cities, he thought, especially capitals, give the impression of being open and busy and full of people going here, there and everywhere, but at heart they're closed, conspiratorial places. He knew this because at one time it had been his job to prise out information from behind the high walls, to infiltrate the defences of impenetrable institutions, and find someone somewhere who was accountable. At one stage his zeal had been ambitious, almost evangelical, until he overstepped the mark. Called powerful people liars, paid informers inside the company, showed that good, decent people with families, friends and Masonic colleagues had been prepared to tolerate bad practice rather than frighten their shareholders. As far as Mabbutt was concerned, his ends had always justified his means. Looking back now, the award he'd won for the water story probably hadn't helped. It had stirred envies, made him look smug and self-righteous in some people's eyes. It certainly made people close ranks against him. But he had been a good journalist, that was for sure, and he had bitterly resented having to make do with crumbs, corporate vanity projects, official histories, publicity puffs of one kind or another. Writing a book about Hamish Melville sounded too good to be true, and that was what worried him. Why would a sleek, smooth, plausible man like Ron Latham have any interest in an iconoclast such as Melville? And the other thing that really rankled was the way the two of them, especially his own fucking agent, for God's sake, had dismissed the novel. Well, he proved them wrong. Albana distilled what he had wanted to say for so long. In Albana, the big issues would take centre stage, and the piffling cover-ups and compromises of modern life would be put firmly in their place. It would be a big story on a big canvas, universal and compassionate, saying everything he wanted to say, no compromise needed. His phone rang. Scylla sounded breathless. She was obviously on the move.
"Where are you?"
"I just took a walk along the river."
"Good news. Ron likes you."
"How could you tell?"
"What?
How can you tell what a robot thinks?"
"Don't be frivolous. All I've got to do now is iron out a few contract details, and I'm pretty sure you've got the job."
Scylla, slow down. Who says I want the job?" There was a pause on the other end of the line.
"What do you mean? What else are you going to do?"
"I have a novel to write."
Your science fiction thing?"
Mabbutt aimed a kick at the wall.
"It's not science fiction. It's historical recreation, documentary drama."
"But it's still fiction. This is for real, Keith. And what's more, I think I can get you real money for it."
Mabbutt looked down. At his feet, a pigeon, quite oblivious to the passing crowds, was worrying away at a stub of discarded falafel.
"Scylla, I told you what I want to do now. You may not have listened, but I did tell you. I don't want to be a hired gun anymore. I have my own plans, and I've taken the decision to concentrate all my time on my novel. This is the only way I will ever produce anything of my own. If Urgent like me that much, then let's talk to them about Albana. An advance wouldn't hurt."
Somewhere in the background, he heard Hector's raised voice, Scylla giving instructions, a door slamming. Then her voice again, a little muffled at first.
"Keith, are you still there?"
"I'm here."
"There is no way that I'm going to get a penny for a science fiction story. It's not, but if I can get what I think I can get for the Melville book, you can write whatever you like for the rest of your life. Shit!"
He heard a squeal of brakes, the blast of a horn, and a cry of anger.
"Sorry, red light, man in front being pedantic. Look, I'm your agent, Keith. My job is to get you work, and believe me, that has not always been easy. Now, I'm just inches away from the best deal I've ever got for you, and I'm not going to walk away from it. I took you on because I knew you were good. This is your chance to prove it. There is no either-or here. This is a great deal. Trust me."
The phone went dead. Mabbutt slipped it into his pocket, pulled up the collar of his coat, and set off in the direction of London Bridge Station. When he got home, Mabbutt checked for phone messages. There were none. He made himself a plate of toast and a cup of coffee, which he carried back up to his study. Having put down a bowl of fresh water for Stanley, and wondered, not for the first time, if his cat might be hydrophiliac, Mabbutt settled at the keyboard, and, adjusting his chair to position 3, straight back, forward tilt, he set to work detailing the physical appearance of Albana, the world that would confront the First Men as they emerged onto the wide and windswept plateau on which their lives would be played out. He enjoyed conjuring up the vista of hard limestone stacks, crumbling gullies and wind-worn cliffs still bearing the scars of some mighty eruption. For at least 20 minutes the images spilled as fluently into his mind as if he were describing the walks he used to take with his father round Ingleborough and Malham Tarn. Then he realised that he was indeed describing the walks he took round Ingleborough and Malham Tarn, and not southeastern Turkey, where his story was putatively set. Rather than delete everything he'd just written, Mabbutt reasoned that there might have been a time when southeastern Turkey could well have resembled Ingleborough and Malham Tarn, and in any case, who would know? There was one further problem. When at last he came to name this great forbidding wasteland, his original thought of calling it Dana sounded all wrong, like a holiday beach in Thailand. What he needed was something with more resonance, something both epic and evil. Mordor had just the right ring to it, which was probably why Tolkien had come up with it in the first place. Once Tolkien had come into his mind, Mabbutt froze up completely. Middle-earth was a no-go area for him. That way fantasy lay, and he simply mustn't let himself be led down that insidious path. All right, there were similarities between his vision and Tolkien's, but Tolkien was old hat. Albana was certainly about the struggle between good and evil, oppression and independence, but it was about so much more besides. After some thought, he rechristened the wilderness Yua, and hoped that no one would know it was one of the Shetland Islands. It was late afternoon when he finally admitted defeat. He rubbed his eyes and stared out of the window, which needed a clean. He was letting the house go. Chris would never have allowed it to get this far. He stood up, stretched, and looked down at his work. This time yesterday morning, he was embarking on something strange and unpredictable, but at least it was a work of fiction. 36 hours later, what was strange and unpredictable was his own life. His wife had a man, his daughter had an Iranian refugee, and he had an offer to write a Christmas book about a living legend. Yesterday's certainties had become today's confusions. What he needed was someone to talk to. He wanted to ring Christina, but that would involve all the other stuff. The same with Jay. Sam would be at the theatre. He could suggest a late supper. Build a few bridges. Yes, that was an idea. Father asked son for advice, a way to start talking again. He took out his phone and scrolled through the names. Then he stopped, scrolled forward, and after the briefest of hesitations, pressed once and pressed again. Hello, Tess. Chapter 6. Tessa was Mabbutt's secret. And as far as he knew, he was hers. They'd met on a night bus about 6 months ago. After a noisy Irish couple had got off at Highbury Corner, they'd been the only two left upstairs. They'd smiled at one another as the noise of the raucously arguing couple receded down the stairs. Vibrating from that nanosecond of contact, they'd sat there, separate but aware, as 5 stops went by. All the way up the Holloway Road, past the Emirates Stadium, under the bridge that carried the East Coast Railway line, past the Odeon Cinema on one side and the Beaux-Arts building on the other, both staring straight ahead. As he stood to get off, she'd stood too. It had almost felt choreographed as he followed her downstairs and stood waiting behind her as the stop approached, the warning signal bleeped, and the doors folded open. They'd fallen in step with each other and began to talk as if it were the most natural thing in the world. He found out that she'd been celebrating a colleague's birthday at a club in Leicester Square. She found out he'd been at a quiz night at a pub in Clerkenwell. As they turned off the main road, he had followed her to the door of a 4-story block of council flats. 9 times out of 10, maybe even 99 times out of 100, this would have been a very silly thing to do. But it turned out to be so easy and uncomplicated that neither of them could see a reason not to do it again. Their relationship was undemanding. It was of the here and now. They inquired very little about each other's past. He knew she was about 5 years younger than him, divorced, with 1 grown-up child who was living in the Northwest. She worked part-time at a children's nursery and led a busy social life. He was fairly sure he wasn't her only partner, which was quite a comfort. outside of sex, their lives remain completely separate. It shouldn't really have happened, and it certainly shouldn't have lasted. But here he was, 6 months on, turning off the main road towards her apartment building, because she was the only person he wanted to be with right now. Even May Lennox, whom he dreamt about on a weekly basis, wouldn't have been the one for him tonight. He needed the welcome embrace of anonymity. Tessa's voice crackled out of the intercom. "Come on up." And the metal gate swung open. Tessa enjoyed the physical side of things. She was well built, a little overweight, but in good shape for her age. For her, sex was like a playground full of different rides, some breathtaking, to be enjoyed with yelps and shrieks, others more traditional, but all to be tried at least once. Her small bedroom was cluttered with knick-knacks, mugs from Ramsgate, Eiffel Towers, polar bears and royal wedding teacups, Russian dolls, wooden puzzles, miniature candlesticks and little rubber elephants, all of which could be sent flying in the course of a night. When Mabbott awoke, light was coming through the curtains. He lay for a while, wondering what it was about this room and this woman that seemed so necessary to him. He concluded that it was because he could walk away and come back whenever he wanted. There were no expectations and therefore no consequences, and no lies. He dozed briefly until his mobile sounded. The first bars of Beethoven's Fifth jangled beside him. It was just after 8 in the morning. Mabbott reached for the phone and swung himself out of the bed.
"Hello? Am I interrupting the creative flow?"
He walked out into the living room.
"Very funny. Things are moving fast. A contract's arrived. I don't want to keep these boys waiting."
Scylla was in steamroller mode.
"Can you come in, dear boy, if at all possible?"
She laid on the sardonicism.
"After you've been to the hairdresser, perhaps, before the gym, maybe combine it with a visit to the chiropodist."
"Just a minute." He searched around for his clothes.
"I'd like to get it signed. It's quite a lot of money." "Ah!"
Mabbott winced with pain as his foot made contact with a tiny glass rabbit.
"Are you with somebody?"
"No, I've just put the milk on. Hang on a minute.
Only I rang the house and you weren't there."
"No, I went to see Sam last night and stayed at his place."
"How was it?"
"What?"
"The play."
"Oh, it was good. You should go and see it."
She lowered her voice.
"The contract is looking good. Best I've seen in a while. But it has confidentiality clauses hanging on it like a Christmas tree. So just for now, keep stumm. Even with Sam. All right?"
"Oh, sure.
Sure. If you can make it here in an hour or so, there are things we need to discuss. And though I love Ron dearly, he's not renowned for his patience."
"Look, Scylla, we have to talk about this."
"Okay.
In an hour, my place. And say hi to Sam."
The phone went dead. Tess called out from the bathroom.
"Another admirer?"
Mabbott peeped through the curtains. Outside he could see children playing or hanging about.
"My agent."
He heard the toilet flush, and a moment later Tess joined him, piling up her long red hair as she walked.
"Something exciting?"
"I must get dressed."
"Don't be so formal."
He made to sidestep her, but she was too quick for him.
"I do breakfast, you know."
Mabbott was enveloped.
"Tess, I promised I'd be at my agency in half an hour."
He felt her warmth as she pulled him close.
"Look, I've got to get..."
"They're over there." She indicated his clothes, heaped on the red armchair like a small deflated pyramid, then stood back and finished pinning up her hair.
"It was nice of you to call last night. I was beginning to think you'd lost the spirit of bachelorhood."
Mabbott pulled on his underpants and reached for his shirt. As he started to button it up, a thought struck him and he paused.
"Can I ask you something, Tess?"
She eyed him cautiously.
"Try me."
"Do you read a lot?"
She put her head to one side.
"Try to."
"So?"
"When you do,"
he said, sitting down on the chair and rooting around for his socks.
"Do you prefer fact or fiction?"
"Oh, fiction, every time. I hate facts."
"Why?"
Facts are just facts.
She shrugged dismissively.
They don't amount to a row of beans. If you want the truth, read Jane Austen.
Chapter 7 Mabbott got off at Queensway on the Central Line, checked his watch and walked to the nearest coffee shop. As he stood in line for a macchiato, he looked at the customers sitting at their tables. One or two alone, reading or staring at their phones, a couple holding hands, a group gathered around a laptop. All much younger than him, most of them preoccupied. What would excite them most? To know more about Hamish Melville, or to be transported back 60,000 years to the dawn of human history? He sat down and sipped his coffee. Usually after a night with Tess, he felt good, comfortable, adjusted, whole. This morning something was troubling him, and he couldn't quite put his finger on what it was. He watched through the window as a telephone engineer, protected by a screen of red and white fencing, opened a terminal box and systematically worked his way through the cables inside. Mabbott observed him with a certain amount of envy. This was a man at work, doing a job, tracing a problem, dealing with it, ticking it off on a worksheet, and moving on to the next one. His tasks for the day were quantifiable, definable, achievable. If only writing could be that simple. Priscilla Caldwell Associates operated out of Silla's flat in a mansion block off Bayswater Road. Apart from some secretarial help, 3 days a week, she ran the business herself from her kitchen table. This morning she was as animated as Mabbott had ever seen her. She almost skipped as she opened the door, phoned to her ear, nodding agreement as she led him through her timber-floored sitting room with its eclectic mix of Corbusier chairs, leather sofas and pine dressers, to a long refectory table spread with sheaves of paper. With one last nod and a grunt of acknowledgement, she clicked off the phone. Her big eyes appraised him.
"Sorry to ring you so early."
Mabbott detected a dusting of disapproval in her voice.
"I've managed to get a good deal from Latham, a very good deal, and I'd like to pin this down before their feet start to chill."
She took a wine gum from a bowl, then pushed it towards him.
"Look, Scylla, you may have decided about this, but I haven't."
She made no appearance of having heard what he said. Instead, she licked her index finger and began to flick through one of the documents on the table.
"Scylla, listen to me. I have made a plan for next year, and it doesn't include Ron Latham or urgent books."
His mobile buzzed. He glanced down. It was a text from Jay.
"Where were you, Dad? We were supposed to have dinner, right?" Oh, God, he'd completely forgotten. And why?
Because his new reordered life had been fucked up by Ron Latham. Scylla selected one of the sheaf of papers and held it out to him.
"Contract. In less than 2 days, what I'd normally have to wait 2 months for."
He took it from her. She stabbed a finger at the pages he was holding.
60,000 on signature, 60,000 on delivery, and 60 on publication. And I'm trying to push them into some kind of cut of foreign rights. They think they can sell this worldwide.
Mabbott's head ached, and his mouth had gone dry. On his contracts, 60,000 usually meant the number of words.
"What's the catch?"
She shrugged and pushed back a lock of hair.
"Must be delivered in 6 months max. Direct interview material from Melville himself, and quite a tough little rider about publisher's approval. But you're new and Latham's paying you well. You'd expect them to protect themselves." "Protect me? Tell them we need more time. Tell them 6 months is impossible." "I don't think that's a good idea," said Scylla dryly. "I'll need to check this, Scylla. I need to check it carefully." "Since when did you check a contract?"
This hurt. It had been so long since there'd been a contract worth him checking. Scylla softened.
"I've been over it 3 times this morning, dear boy."
He dropped the papers back on the table.
"Scylla, aren't you the weeniest, teeniest bit suspicious of all this? Does it not strike you as odd that all my previous contracts have taken weeks to finalise, and suddenly along comes the biggest one ever, and they want it sorted out in 24 hours? I mean, this just doesn't happen."
Scylla took off her reading glasses, rubbed her eyes, and slowly shook her head from side to side. She looked tired. Mabbott had the distinct feeling that she too might have been up all night, albeit for different reasons.
"I've never had a fight with a client for getting them too much money, Keith. This just doesn't happen either."
"It's a perfectly natural question. Why am I suddenly worth all this?"
"Okay, if it makes you feel better, it's not you who are worth all this, it's the book. Latham has decided that this is what he wants. He wants the Melville story. He is convinced it could be a big earner. He also knows that Melville is pathologically opposed to having a book written about him, which, incidentally, adds more than a touch of spice to the project. So, in order to get this book, he has to play a different game. He has to stalk his prey."
"You're talking Ronspeak." Scylla held up her hands.
"Dear boy, hear me out," she said with an edge.
A ginger cat sidled into the kitchen and stared malevolently at Mabbott.
"That means no press releases, no fanfares, and no juicy rumours about some big shot signing up with Urgent to tell the Melville tale. Ron knows that for this to work, his tactics have to be completely the reverse."
She tapped the papers on the table.
"And I supply him with the magic ingredient.
Hair dye.
The best author we can find with no established record of success."
Mabbott threw back his head and laughed.
"That's good, Scylla. I shall put that on my business cards. Keith Mabbott, author, no established record of success."
Scylla stood up. She ruffled her hair and flicked on the kettle behind her.
"It could be worse, Keith. Crap, but successful. That's a much longer list."
Mabbott let out a deep sigh.
"It's unorthodox, dear boy, and I know that beneath that prickly radical exterior lurks a tight-arsed Yorkshire conservative, but believe me, for once, this is good."
The kettle began to hum. Mabbott turned away, but there was no escape. Even the cat was staring at him expectantly.
"What is this, Scylla?"
"The moment of truth." Scylla held out a pen.
"Enjoy it, old boy. Make up for all those moments of untruth."
"Untruth?
All those times you've blamed me for leading you into things you didn't believe in. What did you call them? Parish magazines for blue chip companies? Official histories of pumping stations? Profiles of the chairman? I know you think I'm a cynical old cow, but while I happily admit the pleasure I get from screwing money out of tight-fisted corporate accountants I wouldn't share a taxi with, I'm genuinely proud of this one. Hamish Melville is one of the few good men left, one of the rare people I want to know more rather than less about. And for some wholly inexplicable reason, you have landed the dream job of satisfying my curiosity."
She tapped one of the typed pages.
"And my greed."
She dropped the pen in front of him.
"I honestly believe this is far and away the best thing you will ever do."
Mabbott looked at Scylla. Her dark but well-cut hair framed a sturdy, strong-boned face. A face that was both lively and inscrutable. The face of a survivor. He knew that face, and he knew that look. She wasn't going to back down. Well, neither was he. Not yet.
"I'm sorry, Scylla."
Behind her, the kettle surged, climaxed, and faded. Chapter 8. It was nearly 2 o'clock that afternoon when Mabbott turned off the Edgware Road and, checking his daughter's message one final time, searched for the name Harvey in a row of cafes and shops brimming with sweets and pastries. Outside some were tables where short-haired, broad-shouldered men sat playing draughts and smoking narguilés. He spotted the slim, incongruous figure of his daughter waving to him, almost silhouetted by the bright lights of a cafe's interior. Harvey was small and very busy, and it was a moment or two before he picked out a young man dressed in Western clothes, looking anxiously in their direction. Jay raised her hand towards him, and Mabbott was aware of her attention slipping away from him to this awkward, diffident boy. Yes, he was a boy, who rose to meet her.
"Dad, this is Shiraj."
The boy's dark eyes met his, They showed little animation. Jay rested a hand on his shoulder. He smiled at her, and for some reason shook his head.
Shiraj, this is my dad.
Mabbott reached out and they shook hands. It was no more than a touch of hands, really, hardly a shake.
Sorry I couldn't make it last night, said Mabbott.
They all squeezed around the table, and a waiter brought tea. Shiraj looked so young and so vulnerable. His daughter's awareness of this and her response to it was something that touched Mabbott. She'd always been open and generous with her feelings. He'd regarded this as both her greatest strength and her greatest weakness. And Mabbott felt a tug of envy at the artlessness of her affection. They ate sherbet and drank pomegranate juice. Shiraj had sharp, bird-like features and jet-black eyes that were constantly on the move. He'd been studying English at college in Tehran, but had come under suspicion for spending time with Kurdish groups. He'd been arrested, asked for names he couldn't give, and then beaten up pretty badly and warned not to return to the university.
Were you any threat to the government?
Shiraj smiled thinly.
If you are a Kurd in Iran, then you are always a threat. Guilty until proved innocent.
You're a Kurd?
No, sir.
Then why get involved with them?
Dad, if you knew how these people were treated, you'd...
Quietly but firmly, Shiraj laid a restraining hand on Jay's arm. It was an oddly grown-up gesture, and Mabbott felt bad for misreading him as a boy.
They happened to be my friends, sir, and they needed my help.
He looked Mabbott in the eye.
I was not a martyr. I wasn't a Kurdish nationalist. They were my friends, and they were in trouble.
They stubbed cigarettes out on their arms, for God's sake.
Shiraj looked around in some alarm as Jay's voice rose.
And they'll do the same to Shiraj if our stupid fucking government sends him back. He needs help, Dad.
Please, sir, I am fine. There are people who can help me.
Dad's a journalist. He has contacts.
Mabbott suddenly felt protective towards his daughter, with her innocent, untested idealism. Her frank and generous support for this man she'd only just met, and her loyal and totally unjustified belief in her father.
I would like to be a journalist,
Shiraj said quite decisively.
All my friends want to be journalists.
Mabbott looked around the room. At every table were men deep in conversation, eyes staring into eyes, arms constantly rising and falling, hands in perpetual motion, fluttering and turning with sharp and delicate gestures. Everyone seemingly engaged in the most important arguments of their lives. It wasn't quite the same in the Dog and Feathers. Was it the lack of muddling alcohol, or was it just that these people had more to discuss, or that the customers in a place like Harvey were in someone else's country, and there was so much that mattered?
Do you write for a newspaper, sir?
Me? No.
Mabbott didn't quite know where to go from here. A history of Sullomvo oil terminal wouldn't cut much ice, but this eager young man needed something.
I write books, mostly.
Shiraj nodded. His serious dark eyes rested on Mabbott.
He's writing a novel, said Jay proudly.
Shiraj's brow furrowed.
What is this novel?
Yes, tell us, Dad. I haven't a clue what it's about.
Mabbott wanted to give a fluent, enthusiastic answer, but the unfamiliar smells of herbs and rosewater and fresh-baked bread, combined with the intense chatter of people talking in a language he didn't understand, made him feel a sudden wobbling of resolve.
It's a story, he said to Shiraj.
Is it true?
No, that's the point. It's a story. Like the Arabian Nights.
Shiraj's brow furrowed.
That was a long time ago.
Yes, well...
You should write about what is happening today.
Mabbott noticed Jay give Shiraj's arm the lightest of touches.
With respect, sir, I could tell you some true stories you would not believe.
Mabbott thought of Tess. How had she put it?
Sometimes you can tell the truth better through stories, he replied.
Shiraj leant towards him. His tone remained even, but he spoke a little faster.
Forgive me, sir. With respect, there are too many good people telling stories, when what we need is to tell the world the facts.
Jay crooked her finger and scoured the last of the sherbet from the rim of her glass.
He's right in a way, Dad.
Youthful idealism had always irritated Mabbott, especially when it was fluently expressed. He'd been a martyr to it himself. Vietnam, Watergate, civil rights. The world's problems, which he and his friends were convinced could all be sorted out from the safety of Hull University. He felt Shiraj's eyes flick back to him, and as the boy leaned in, he caught the faintest scent of jasmine.
You were a journalist, sir?
I was. Shiraj tapped the table, emphatically, as if this proved his point.
Then I must tell you the story of my people, and you can write about it. In my country, no one will write this. They will be arrested, like my father. He was a journalist, and my brothers were trying to find him, and they have been arrested.
Mabbott nodded. More people squeezed onto the table. The cafe was busier than ever. He felt his own enthusiasm being appropriated by this eager young man. It was not only wearing him out, it was making him feel inadequate.
If you don't mind, I must go.
He rose and shook the young man's hand.
It's been good to meet you, Shiraj. I'll
do what I can. Jay caught up with him as he stepped into the street.
Sorry, Dad. I could see you were feeling hassled. It's just that he's been through stuff he could never talk about. And now he's in London, everything matters to him. All at once.
Mabbott turned back to the cafe. Through the window, Shiraj caught his glance, smiled uncertainly, then looked away.
I guess he could use the spare room. And, well, we'll take it from there,
said Mabbott, giving Jay a kiss. As he crossed the road, he saw her skipping back into the cafe. By the time he got back to Resserton Road, it was late afternoon. That dark hour for any writer. He checked the cricket. No play. Rain. There was a message on the answer phone, which he could listen to either straight away or after an hour's writing. He listened to it straight away. It was his soon-to-be ex-wife. She and Rex will be dining at a little bistro he knows in Chelsea. She pleaded with Mabbott to come and just say hello. In disgust, Mabbott switched off the message. The phone rang again, almost immediately, but it wasn't Christina.
Okay, dear boy, this is what's happening. I've told Urgent about your worries about deadlines and the novel and how much it means to you, and instead of just telling us to piss off, which they were entirely within their rights to do, they are prepared to discuss these concerns with you.
Scylla,
just hear me out. Ron Latham has agreed to meet up tonight at his office.
Scylla,
go through all your misgivings one by one, and he will give you absolute reassurances on all the points that concern you. I'll be there too, and hopefully we can put your troubled mind at rest.
Mabbott felt assailed and confused. After the oddly disquieting chat with young Shiraj, he wanted time and space to think. The last thing he needed was a return to Urgent's bleak and spiritless office and the hard sell from Latham and Scylla.
He'll meet us at 7:30, okay?
Mabbott took a deep breath.
No, Scylla, it's not okay.
What do you mean? We let this whole thing drop? We watch while someone else gets the commission? This could be our last chance.
Mabbott switched the phone to his other hand. His parents smiled at him from the sideboard. A perfect storm of options was swirling about him, and he had to take one of them, fast.
Tell him I've got something more important to do.
Scylla's voice rose.
More important? How's that going to go down? I'm sorry, Mr. CEO of Major Publishing Company, but the author of The Official History of Sullom Voe's got something more important to do.
Mabbott cleared his throat.
It happens to be true. It's a very important dinner. Dare I ask? Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama? With my wife, if you must ask.
He put down the phone, and after a long, deep breath, rewound the answer phone and wrote down an address. Chapter 9. It was certainly more than a bistro. So discreetly appointed was it that he walked past three times, thinking it some kind of electrical substation. There was no sign, but incised into a smoked glass strip beside the hammered metal door were the almost indecipherable words, Atelier Gaston Cartes. The door required two hands to prise it open. As it swung to, Mabbott found himself running a gauntlet of mirrored glass leading to yet another door. He was preparing himself to heave this open when it slid to one side with a hiss. He found himself in a carefully dimmed steel cave in which were set some 20 tables, black glass on silver chrome, only one of which was occupied. Christina was sitting with her back to him, so it was her companion whose eye he caught first. A tallish, disappointingly good-looking older man with a high colour, flecks of white hair streamlined at the temples, and a well-fed frame tucked neatly into a three-piece suit. It crossed Mabbott's mind that this might have been what Christina's father looked like. Christina appeared strained, but seemed to be relieved to see him. Stiffly, she embarked on the introductions. Her companion rose from the table, smiling amiably, and grasped Mabbott's hand before lapsing back into his seat. He beckoned Mabbott to do the same, with a gesture of elegant largesse, as if he owned the place.
"Rex owns the place," said Christina.
Rex gave a self-deprecating smile.
"Actually, it was opened by a Ukrainian. Frightful crook. Went belly up a year ago, so we took it over. We came up with the name Gaston Cartes, and it's taken off. Chef's from Inverness."
Mabbott looked dubiously at the surrounding gloom.
"It picks up. The high rollers like to eat late. Glass of champagne?"